Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the East-West Psychology Podcast, the forum for the exploration of psyche and spirit. Join our hosts, Jonathan Kay and Stefan Julich, and their guests as they delve into the intersection of psychology, philosophy, world wisdom traditions, the arts, and more.
In this episode, we meet Axe student Devdeep Ganguly and learn about his upbringing in the Sri Aurobindo ashram in Pondicherry, India. Devdeep discusses his experiences growing up in an intentional yogic community and shares his perspectives on integral education as both a student growing up in the ashram school and as a teacher in the school for over a decade. This episode, which is the first part of our conversation, ends discussing the differences and similarities between the ashram and Auroville, which is a close-by experimental and spiritual township founded on the principles of spiritual anarchy by the mother in 1968. Welcome to another edition of the East-West Psychology Podcast. I'm Jonathan Kay, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Stefan Julich. How are you, Stefan?
Jonathan, I'm running behind this morning, but I should catch up. Hopefully, I'll catch up by the time we finish the podcast.
Sounds about par for the course for both of us. And we are very honored to have a new student in the AXE program with us today, an MA student, Devdeep Ganguly. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Hi, Devdeep.
So I think let's just dive right in to getting to know you a little bit. I think that you are just a fantastic person to have on the podcast, Devdeep, because of so many reasons, but especially to help kind of bring out your relationship to integral yoga, to the place in which it was really born in Pondicherry, which is where you're from, and you are a part of the ashram there. You teach at the ashram school, and you're very much situated in the place in which integral yoga was cultivated around Sri Aurobindo and the mother. And CIIS, as most people will know by now, has inherited this as part of its heritage, its lineage, through Haridas Chaudhary, who Sri Aurobindo sent to California. And so I think that you're going to be able to really give a lot of students and other listeners of the podcast much more of a situated taste and experience of what it's like to have grown up there and to be part of the pedagogy of what integral education looks like. So can you just tell us a little bit about how you came to be in the ashram, and a little bit about your upbringing in India and what brought you into teaching in the ashram school, for instance?
Yes, and thank you for the warm welcome, Stephen and Jonathan. It's really a pleasure and honor for me to be on the podcast with you. I feel really grateful that I came into this atmosphere, this tradition, without really, at least in my conscious, without consciously really deciding to. So I was born into it. My association with this place goes back to four generations. So my great-grandfather came to Pondicherry from Bengal. He was a lawyer, and he came on some legal work to help the ashram. And when he was here, he decided to stay on, and he moved here. And subsequently, he passed away pretty early, actually, in the 60s. So not many people even here know of him. But he was one of the first teachers in the ashram school in the 1940s, and also the first registrar of the ashram school. And subsequently, my parents were also students in the ashram school. My mother's family also moved here from Bengal in the 50s. And so it's been really an association which goes back a long time, but more importantly, growing up, this felt like home, it felt like family. And for me, that's one of the most beautiful things about the ashram school and the ashram as well, that it's a community, a family of aspirants, of people who are drawn to this vision, who share in this ideal. And so it was kind of obvious for my parents that their children should come to study in the ashram school. They didn't live in Pondicherry. After they finished their education at the ashram in 1970, they had their own trajectory. They went all over. And we were living in Delhi when I moved to Pondicherry at the age of 8, 9 to study in the ashram school. So my early education was actually in a very conventional setup. And I remember I have vivid memories of going to a very regular school in Delhi with a big, you know, a bag of books on the back, as is often the case in India, and studying in a system which was oriented towards exams and so on. And I moved from that to the ashram school. I stayed in a boarding. I went straight in to the entire program. And it was an extraordinary experience, because I think I valued what I was getting here even more because I was coming from outside, from a school that was conventional. So when I moved here, I think even sometimes more than some of my classmates who had grown up here from the age of 3 and who perhaps didn't realize how special this was, I was really conscious of how special this place was. And so I was familiar with Pondicherry. I used to keep visiting because my aunts and grandaunts and various other relatives lived in Pondicherry. So I used to visit them in summer holidays and things like that. So I felt already at home from day one. And then coming into the school, I really wanted to make the most of the place. And the school, we'll talk more about the school, but I felt that I wanted to do everything all at once. And I was soaking up whatever I could, get from this atmosphere. So I ended up in the ashram, in the school. And then when I finished, I moved through the school. And then when I finished the college, the equivalent of a bachelor's or undergraduate degree here, though this is not an institution which awards degrees, but the equivalent of that program, when it was over, by then I felt convinced that I wanted to stay on in Pondicherry and contribute to this place and continue my journey here.
I'm wondering, just as I'm listening to you, I'm curious if your parents ever articulated for you why they decided to come back after leaving.
So they actually didn't come back, but they sent us, me and my elder brother. So they continued to work in Delhi until they retired, like just 5, 6 years ago, and then moved to Pondicherry. But we grew up here in the ashram. The school is both residential as well as a boarding school. So we grew up in the boardings. And the boardings, of course, are they're really like extended homes. I mean, you have elderly, we call them didis or dadas, like older sisters or older brothers who look after you. And so I came straight into the boarding from home. But I think for them, the decision to send us here was spontaneous, and it felt like the natural thing to do since they grew up here and they really valued what they received here. And I was very keen to come, and I had to wait for a few years, and I was really, really very eager to make it to the ashram school. And so I was finally able to do that.
And you tell us a little bit about learning in the school and, going on to become a teacher in the school as well. I spent time when I lived in Kolkata for about 10 years. I was in Pondicherry regularly. One of the aspirations that I have was like, I wish I could I go to university here? And they're like, no, you can't do that. But I'm like, but where can I learn more and more about, like, how can I get into these, the very rich and deep texts, like the Life Divine and Synthesis of Yoga. And I figured that the university knowledge, right, it's called, yes, would be the place to do that. But anyway, I just am also very curious about alternative pedagogies. And, you know, in one of our classes, which you were in, and Stefan teaches his class Knowledge Work in the Modern Academy. And I think that we get to the place where, you know, we are trying to situate people in what is the, like you're talking about, like the normal experience of school, mostly in, let's say, North America, but like you're drawing that distinction in India as well. There's a kind of a public school and things work a certain way. Can you just talk a little bit more about your experience as a student and then going on to be a teacher in, and what this alternative pedagogy does, what it looks like?
Absolutely. So I need to situate the school in the context of the ashram, especially for, you know, your listeners who may not be aware of the little world we have here. So the ashram literally is the home of a teacher or a spiritual master. In this case, of course, Sri Aurobindo and the mother. And for a long time, Sri Aurobindo, of course, says that the ashram founded itself rather than was founded. That's because I don't think there was the intention to have a large community from the time that he came to Pondicherry. It kind of happened organically. So people kept coming, and as people kept coming, the life of the community got organized. In 1926 is sort of a year which is marked as the beginning of the ashram, in a sense, because that's when Sri Aurobindo withdrew to his room and the mother came forward to kind of guide the community, both internally, externally. And for a long time, there were no children in the ashram or families. The people who came here were selected individually by Sri Aurobindo and the mother. They were very careful to choose those persons whom they thought were capable of doing this yoga. And when you read the letters that were written by Sri Aurobindo to the sadhaks right through the 1930s, you get a feel of how intense and how sincere, how dedicated the aspirants or sadhaks, as we call them in India, were. And then something changed with the Second World War. So with the Second World War, you had Japan approaching India on its eastern border, and there were incidents of Japanese planes flying over Calcutta and other parts of Bengal and dropping a few bombs. And that was, though the Japanese eventually didn't make it into India, but they came really close. They came right up to the border. And so there were families in Bengal who came with their children, who moved away, anticipating, you know, potential problems. They moved to Pondicherry with their children. And when the children came here, the mother said that obviously we can't expect the children to lead the life of the sadhaks. They haven't chosen to do yoga or come here to do yoga. So we have to have a school. But if we're having a school, from the very beginning, I think she began to conceptualize a center of education which would be completely different from regular schools. And something aligned to Sri Aurobindo's and her own vision of education. So the school starts very informally in 1943, and it grows from there initially slowly, but then in the 50s, it has a very rapid expansion, and there is a whole vision which takes shape. The history of the school is fascinating, but I think if we talk too much about it, it'll prolong our discussion, you know, beyond the hour. So let me just talk about what my education felt like being a student. So I came here in the early 1990s, when I was 9 years old. And I think a few things struck me. The first, of course, is the sense that this was not an institution you went in the morning and came back from in the evening. It was an atmosphere in which you were immersed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, right through the year. So the feeling that this was a space of learning that didn't end or begin at a certain time of the day or geographically, you were just always in the atmosphere of the ashram. And I thought that was very special. I already mentioned sense of community or family. So in the ashram school, none of the teachers are here to make a career because they aren't paid in the first place. And there are no, there's no, you know, hierarchy. There is, of course, an administrative organization, but there is no no sense that you will be promoted in your job or you will have, you know, it's not like you are here to build a career. So they are all the faculty members, teachers, the sports instructors, or captains, as we call them, coaches, they are all here primarily doing this work as an offering, as a part of their sadhana. And so that changes the nature of the relationship. Similarly, the students who are in the school are not paying to learn, and the teachers are not paid to teach. So it completely changes the dynamic of the space, and the whole objective becomes, from the side of the students, of course, learning and growing in this atmosphere. And from the side of the teachers, how do you create such an atmosphere in which there can be an integral approach to learning? And so broadly, what I sensed is that when we were younger, there was a lot more discipline, emphasis on discipline and schedules. We had to learn the basics of the main subjects like arithmetic, geography, history. We got a grounding in knowledge, so to say, which the tools to learn were kind of inculcated. So you developed the mind through languages, through arithmetic, and through various things. You started developing certain interests like carpentry or music or dance or whatever appealed to you. And so in the early stage, it was sort of more programmed for you with some choice of freedom available to you to make certain decisions about what you wanted to do. But from the time that you were 15, 16 is when there is a radical change that started to take place. There's something known as the free progress method of learning or working. And in the free progress, we were able to choose our subjects and eventually choose our teachers and then sit with them and work out what we wanted to do, how we wanted to do it. It was almost like designing your own curriculum. But of course, it varied. Some teachers were more open to this way of working. Others were more conventional in their approach. But by and large, as we grew older, we experienced more freedom. And when we entered the ashram college at the age of 17, 18, it was a blank timetable. And you basically decided what you wanted to do with your time. And so for me, this freedom was really special. And I remember when I was 15 or 16, I just enjoyed the fact that I could have time to just sit by myself, to read, to sit in the silence room, which was a space where you could, you know, go and sit quietly, read or sleep for all, you know, for all you want. There was this sense of no boundaries in terms of learning. You did what you wanted to do. And so that was my experience as a student. And of course, there's another very important component. So when we say integral education in the ashram, what we mean by that is an education which addresses all the different parts of the being. So the physical body, the vital being and its emotions and its feelings, and the mental being and the development of the mind. And most importantly, the development of the soul or the psychic being within, which is supposed to be the integrating power. So all of these instruments, body, life, and mind, are meant to be in the ideal, you know, development. They're meant to be integrated around or led by the psychic. And what is interesting in the ashram is that there are no classes on how to find your psychic being or your soul. There is no instruction on, you know, on teaching such a thing. You really can't teach it. And I think what you can do is at best create an atmosphere where in those individuals in whom the seeking is there or the questioning is there, they are able to find some answers or some guidance. And for me, the spaces that allowed that to happen were spaces like the Samadhi, which is just across the street from the school. So the Samadhi is the resting place of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, which is kind of the heart of the ashram. It's just a simple marble stone in a courtyard under a beautiful tree. And you could go whenever you want and sit there, reflect, contemplate. There was never any obligation to attend, a meditation or to participate in any kind of spiritual training. But the fact that there were these spaces like the silence room, the Samadhi, we started the day with a 5-minute concentration. And even before, when we did sports, there was a 2-minute concentration in the beginning and at the end. So there were just little reminders, but these were absolutely silent in the sense that there was nobody instructing you on what to do. You imbibed whatever you could. And the other thing was the space, the school and the college. So you had quotations on the board, you had books in the libraries which you could go and pick up and read. And there were, most importantly, I think, and this is really important, we had teachers who were practitioners. So these were individuals who were themselves seeking and doing this work as an offering. And so you couldn't help being influenced or catching something of that spirit. And so it was really teaching by example, by lived example, by which I don't mean to say that the teachers in the ashram school were or are perfect or, sadhaks of the highest order. I think we saw everything in terms of all kinds of temperaments and characters and difficulties that people, we all have with our nature and so on. So there was the whole gamut of human experience, but there was an overarching sense of purpose and direction which permeated the atmosphere. And I think for whoever was sensitive and who picked up on it, it felt like something meaningful.
That's really lovely. I was spending the morning before Jonathan had to text me to remind me that we were going to meet today. I was listening to a lecture by Rudolf Steiner, and Steiner himself helped founded an educational movement also, the Waldorf education. My daughter was raised in a Waldorf school. And I'm struck by similarities and differences between the two of them. But one of the things that was really important is in Steiner education or in Waldorf education is that it's an education towards freedom. So I was really struck with what you were saying about the freedom that you were given to kind of find your own way. But that seems really consonant with the entirety of the teaching of the mother and Sri Aurobindo to me, that it's not about a top-down imposition. It's really about entering into that heart space, into the psychic being, and allowing it to guide you in life. Mm-hmm. The other thing that struck me is when you brought up the fact that the teachers that you were working with were all practitioners. So, of course, I would guess that within the ashram community that the practices revolved around integral yoga. But that ideal is also present in CIIS. And I'm wondering, I don't know enough about about what Haridas Chaudhary brought with him in terms of his desire to kind of reproduce or to maybe carry the mother's educational thoughts here to California. But there is also, we often say within East-West psychology, and I think it's true in other programs also, that we're encouraging the scholar-practitioner model, but the teachers themselves are also really, what's the right word, encouraged to bring their own inner practices, their own spiritual practices into the classroom. It doesn't have to be explicit, but there's no it's not hidden the way that it is in a conventional institution. Mm-hmm. I would guess it's this, it may be the same in India, but it's certainly that way here in the US, where the teacher, it's fine if the teacher is a devout Christian or a yogi or anything, but it really can't be brought into the classroom. So it's fascinating to me the way that this lives in our classrooms at CIIS. But I'm also struck in what you're saying, and I'm thinking that it may actually have been an ideal that was brought here by Chaudhry. I don't know if either of you know.
No, I wouldn't know about that. But I get what you're saying, Stephen, because in the little time that I have spent studying this term at CIIS, you do feel the sense that the professors are bringing a kind of sincerity of intention and practice into the classroom. And it's something so far, at least, which is conveyed quite quite naturally and without being in any way overbearing or forced. And I feel that especially in anything to do with spiritual practice, that is essential. Any movement of teaching which feels like it's being, you know, imposed or somehow has the atmosphere of, you know, proletizing, I feel is very counterproductive and evokes very often the opposite reaction. No, so I was just saying, in the ashram, I think what was quite unique is, in a sense, how little people spoke about spirituality in the classroom, and yet somehow you felt it was all around you. And that's very interesting, I feel, and important.
Mm-hmm. I think that the tendency that I've seen growing up, and I grew up in a very secular America. I grew up during the 60s. I was going to primary school in the 60s, 1960s, and the teachers were very careful not to bring this into the classroom. And I think that there's a way in which the Abrahamic religions are proselytizing religions, and often to come within the influence of a religion or a creed in the West often means adopting a set of beliefs. So there's a catechism, for instance, in Catholicism, but that sort of thing exists in all of the kind of main Abrahamic faiths. It's believed that there's a correct way of seeing and being, and they're incorrect. And of course, there's a lot of room for argument, but there's still this basic assumption. And so it was kind of pushed aside for in mainstream American education for good reasons. At the same time, I think that it was difficult for faculty members to bring their interior life into the classroom. So there became this kind of a bifurcation. And I think that that's just a result of trying really hard to set what we call a separation of church and state. And many of the private schools in our country that, you know, when my daughter was growing up, they were called magnet schools, but many of these small schools that were developing were Christian, and the students that would go into them were actually being indoctrinated into the form of Christianity that the school was founded under. So I've always appreciated the Mother and Sri Aurobindo's attitude. I'm even going so far as to say that they were not founding a religion, that they're not gurus. Although even for me, it's very difficult not to look at them in that light and to not feel a sense of devotion. You know, I've been to Pondicherry and spent hours and hours and hours in the samadhi, and it was, I would have to say, it was a religious experience for me in a broad and very positive sense. But never once have I felt like I was being indoctrinated. And I think that that's one of the graces of what they've brought in their teaching. I think it's there's a subtle difference, maybe not so subtle, but subtle at the same time.
You know, I just want to circle back to what you said about freedom in education. And I feel like definitely this is one of the gifts of this place, like the freedom that we had to explore our interests and who we were and what we wanted to do without, because I forgot to mention that there are no examinations. The mother didn't believe in the whole system of examinations. So right from the age of 3 till the age of 21, you actually aren't sitting for an exam which determines or has any consequence in terms of whether you pass or fail, or you go to the next, you're promoted or not. So the whole aspect of fear is removed, and that is a gift. At the same time, I feel like sometimes we highlight freedom without giving sufficient importance to discipline. And that's another thing which I felt I picked up here, is especially through the sports, but also in school, that freedom is not doing whatever you feel like if your own sense of purpose and motivation is not clear to you. And so discipline and will are really important to develop and grow at the same time. And when you have a clear and conscious will is when you can exercise that freedom in the right way. A teacher of ours who unfortunately passed away recently, very dear to us, Christophe, French gentleman, he used to often joke that free progress is not the freedom not to progress. It's not free of progress. You're just free in how you want to progress, the manner in which you want to progress. And I think that's very important, because sometimes I feel educators, especially when they talk about schools, and I've had this discussion with a lot of my friends in other alternative, you know, who have children in alternative setups like in Oroville and so on, and they often have this debate about what is freedom really in the context of education and for a child. Like, and so I think the two things really are important, and I think that there is a balance that even here we are constantly striving to achieve. And I just want to add one more thing, is that looking back, I was just thinking about the teachers that I had, and I mentioned the old sadhaks, but it was also really fun to have teachers who came in from outside for brief periods, and they brought in a lot of vitality and perspective. And I really enjoyed my interactions with such teachers as well. And interestingly, many of them were from the US. So I remember, for example, Praveer Malik, who taught us for a few years, and he came from the US, and then now he's back there. There was Prapanna, I think his American name is Randall Smith. Anyway, Prapanna had a son who was in the ashram school, and we really enjoyed his classes. And then he went back to the US and tried to, I believe he ran a school which was kind of inspired by free progress for a while before he was not able to continue with that. There was Nancy Whitlow. She was here for a long time, but she was also American, and she taught us Shakespeare. So I mean, I'm just thinking about the fact that there was also this balance between people who were very much here for a long time and others who came with fresh impetus. And I think that is also interesting, because the ashram attracts a lot of people who want to participate or contribute in some way or the other.
Yeah. I you know, I used to say to my daughter, who maybe around your age, I don't know, she's 37, just 37. So I used to say to her, you know, freedom is not license. Right? Freedom does not mean license to do whatever you want. She used to beg to disagree with me. But in Waldorf education, one of the central tenets, or one of the central practices, I guess you could say, is practice towards reverence. They really feel that it's important for children to have a sense of reverence, because through that sense of reverence and respect, they develop a respect for such things as self-discipline. and for really taking seriously the life that they've been given, this opportunity that they've been given, and how they will live their life. But even, you know, it's, I mean, America is known for brashness in a way, and in American schools, even in Waldorf schools, children often struggled with that and fought against it because they saw reverence as a way of capitulating one's autonomy to an authoritarian figure. Anyway, so I was always really keen to listen. I worked at my daughter's school for 8 years as a chef, so I wasn't a teacher. I was the one person in the school who was able to say yes to the students all the time. But I was always fascinated with the pedagogy and with the way teachers, and each of them was an individual, the way in which they approached their students, and what lay behind that, because there was a lot of meetings, a lot of training in Waldorf education. So I'm curious about that also in the ashram school and within kind of in the educational philosophy of the Mother and Sri Aurobindo. So I'm curious about your experience as a teacher.
Yeah, thank you. So as I was finishing, we call it higher course, that is the ashram college. So as I was finishing the higher course, I mean, it's quite ironical, actually, because as I entered the higher course, I was very clear that I wanted to, as soon as I finished here, I would, or perhaps even before I finished, I wanted to leave and go into a conventional university. I was kind of drawn to the idea of economics, and I wanted to study economics, even in the US. And I almost made that shift. But interestingly, in higher course, I started reading the works of Sri Aurobindo, and I was really lucky to have some very, very fine teachers, Jugal Kishore Mukherjee, maybe you've read some of his books, Manoj Das, Hriday Narayan. Anyway, so these were all people who had engaged with Sri Aurobindo's writings for years. And so it was really a pleasure to study these texts with them. And then very gradually, my whole outlook kind of changed, and I felt like, oh my God, I need many years to absorb what I'm getting here. And the 3 years of college are not enough for me. And so as I was ending the higher course, I felt more and more strongly that I wanted to remain in Pondicherry, continue this journey, this growth, this learning in this unique atmosphere. And so when I finished my college, I decided to, you know, stay on and help in whatever way I could in the ashram. And I was, apart from some other responsibilities that I was given, I was also asked to teach in the ashram school. And right from almost from the beginning, I was asked to teach in the ashram college and to take up works of Sri Aurobindo, which I had studied, and actually teach them or do a course around them to students. And that was a fascinating experience, mainly because it was so overwhelming. My first students were a year or two younger than me, and I knew them very well. And now it was suddenly on the other side of the table. But it was also really interesting because very quickly I figured that teaching in the ashram is really a form of learning, and that anyway, this was a way for growth to happen. So the whole focus shifted from, I need to know my subject and be able to teach it, to, I want to grow together with my students and grow in my understanding and share with them and learn from them and give whatever little I can. And so the teaching takes on a very different feel, because again, I think we are all conscious of the fact that we are trying to manifest a very new form of education, even though we are all very much sort of bridging two worlds. Like, we are still stuck in our normality, if I may put it. We are aspiring for something which transcends it. And so the teaching somehow, I feel, is really, really precious, because at least in those moments, you rise up, you try to rise up to the highest of yourself and hold it forward, because you want to act from that poise and that center. And for me, it became a means, it is a means of spending time with Sri Aurobindo's texts and of sharing with my students and also listening to them and learning from them. And it's really an adventure and something which I've enjoyed very much. And it's also subtle in this. What I mean by subtle is I feel like the classroom space is one where you are not only giving, but you're also listening to how the students are responding. Class sizes in the ashram are very small. Since we don't have exams and any of that, they're kept very small so that students and teachers are able to really interact and teachers can figure out how they can shape the class based on the interests and needs of the students. So I have at most, you know, typically in some classes I have 3-4 students, in others I have more, but it's a space where there is listening happening on both sides. We are kind of shaping it along, aligning the class to what the students want or need. So it's a very transformative and growth-oriented space. The mother used to say the ideal teacher has to be a yogi. And I think that feels like it's such a difficult ideal because, you know, the more you go along, the more you recognize just how much you have to work on yourself. And it's like a never-ending journey, but it's fascinating. And it's like, it's an adventure.
It's beautiful. And I do love that idea of the adventure of consciousness or whatnot. And this is such a great conversation. And on that point, I mean, the ideal teacher as a yogi, it makes sense to me because the sadhak, let's say the sadhak, a yogi, maybe we can think of something that is some ideal that's outside of us or not even reachable or reachable in some indefinite future. But really the aspirant, the sadhak is a yogi in becoming in a way. And although there are different levels, different experiences, different realizations come along with that. But to me, it seems like you're sharing that there's this at the very core of everything is really that receptivity, that openness to the psychic presence, the psychic being. And the yogi or the sadhak in this case is going to be the person that has spent time looking within, finding how the planes and the parts of their being are in relation to each other, to the relation to the psychic being. They've observed the habits of their own nature. And then they're able to be open to that in somebody else. You look, it's like the subjective science of yoga is subjective, but it's also, so there's something, there's overlapping between different subjectivities, for instance. And so I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of the teacher really, I guess, like we talked about, on other episodes, the scholar practitioner, but it's really in a way, it's like there's knowledge cultivation here between two people or in collectivities, small collectivities. But there's also a practice of self-knowledge. And I think that all of this really, to me, it's decentering that kind of the radical individualistic approach to philosophy, or to metaphysics or epistemology. A lot of the principles of humanism that are brought into our kind of our normative education are based on these kind of binaries. Like there's the teacher and then there's the student. It's a binary. There's, and so I think that's where the yogic metaphysics is giving us a whole different kind of canvas to grow with others. And it really disrupts, well, there is no absolute individual here. There is an individual experience, but it's not closed off from the other in an absolute sense. It's like, well, we are all divine. We are all one. There's a monism that pervades in the psychic being is the way in which we can know our differences as well as know that we are opening to something of a same nature. So I guess if we could quickly, not quickly, but if we could transition into thinking a little bit along these lines in terms of your experiences in the ashram and Oroville being two very different places, We have a class going to Oroville from East West Psychology Department. I took the class in 2018, and then I'm going to be TAing under the direction of Debashish Banerjee, our chair. And when I was going to Pondicherry, I was mostly in Pondicherry. My guru of music was he spent a lot of time in the Pondicherry, the ashram environment. He had a lot of friends there. He grew up there, actually. He just shared a picture of him when he was, I think, 4 years old, singing in the playground, doing a concert. And Nolini Da was there amongst other sadhaks at the time. And so he's very much embedded in the ashram atmosphere. And then I also got experiences to go to Oroville, and I noticed quite a difference there in the culture, in the aesthetic, the ethic. Everything about the place seemed quite different to me. But maybe you could speak a little bit about that, about your experiences in these places, their differences.
Sure. So are you coming in summer, Jonathan, again to Oroville?
Yeah.
Oh, great. So we'll have a chance.
We'll see you.
Yes. So yeah, I think I mentioned that the ashram really feels like a family. The defining characteristic of the ashram is that everyone who is here has consciously chosen the Mother and Sri Aurobindo as their spiritual teacher or master or guru, and that they are trying, each of us trying in our own way to the best of our abilities, with all our defects and limitations, to grow in that path and to really consciously participate in that evolutionary process. So having said that, the ashram is a very vibrant and diverse community. It consists of people from many different parts of India. I would say about 10% are foreign nationals, but it's much more Indian in its feel than Oroville is. And also there are lots of different departments. So everybody in the ashram does some work as part of their offering. And so it's a community which is in many ways self-sustaining. We have farms, we grow our own food, there are medical facilities, there's the school, the different units and departments which have evolved over time. The unique advantage of the ashram over Oroville is that by the time the mother left her body in 1973, the basic structure and life of the ashram was already in place. So externally, there isn't much that needed to happen to give shape to the ashram. That was already done by the mother when she was there. And she was very astute manager at every level, and she put into place a system by which even after she left, the outer administrative functioning of the ashram continues through a trust and so on and so forth. So the ashram continues to basically run pretty much the way it always has. Of course, there are some changes with regard to time and technology and all of that, but by and large, it has a rhythm which is unchanged for all these years. And there is a trust with trustees who are kind of the administrative overseers of the community, but they are not accorded any particular spiritual function. So it is still the presence of Mother and Sri Aurobindo. There's no lineage or a succession of gurus here. It's very much the presence and their teachings as expressed in Sri Aurobindo's writings, the mother's writings, her recordings. So it's all of that which kind of makes up the ashram. Also, the ashram is varied in the sense that there are people who are inmates, meaning people who have dedicated themselves fully for ashram work. There are volunteers, that is, persons who may not be living full time in the ashram, but they are contributing in whatever way they can. There are devotees who come and go. To me personally, I feel that these distinctions are very secondary. It's not a question, it's not a spiritual hierarchy. It's much more a question of practical organization. And I find some, very sincere sadhaks, regardless of whether they're ashramites or volunteers or devotees. So it's got nothing to do with that, but it's more to do with the practical organization. So the ashram kind of continues in very much the way it has over the years. Of course, it's a community, a living community. So it has its ups and downs, its moments of crises and all of that. But by and large, it's really held together really well, considering the mother's physically not here since 73. So it's like 50 years now. It's really remarkable how there is still a fundamental feeling of sincerity and commitment that you feel here. I have been engaging with Orville right from the time that I finished my studies. I was very curious about Orville, and I would go out as much, you know, as I could in the beginning to know more about the place. I was lucky to make really good friendships with Orwellians. And I count, you know, some of my closest friends are Orwellians. And I was able to understand their experience of living in another communities, very close geographically, just 15 kilometers, but really two different worlds. And also, I lived through a time when I'm living through, you know, over the last 20 years is a time when there has been a lot of positive interactions and exchanges between the ashram and Orville, which was not always the case. And so this is when we have many interesting, you know, interactions. And I was really able to see up close the community and what how it's different and also how it's similar. So for some of your listeners who may not be aware, Jonathan, you have Orville, which was started in 1968, dream of the mother to have a universal township where people from all around the world can live in goodwill and harmony, where they can find a unity which is based on an inner sense of identity rather than an external uniformity, a unity which can support this tremendous diversity of people from everywhere, different cultures, different backgrounds, and kind of a living experiment of human unity, a laboratory of human unity. And so it has had its own history. But what is remarkable is that you have, just like in the ashram, I feel that in Orville, you have a very solid base of really committed persons who are really inspired by the dream and vision of Orville and seeking to give, you know, to manifest it. And the difference between, I mean, there are many differences between the two communities. So organizationally, at a certain point in time, there was a conflict between Orwellians and the Sri Aurobindo Society, which was the body that was buying the lands of Orville in their name. And after the mother's passing, these two entities got into conflict, the Sri Aurobindo Society and Orville. And so there was a period of hardship and crisis in Orville. And eventually the government of India stepped in. There was an act of parliament creating an autonomous body known as the Orville Foundation, which would kind of oversee in spirit the its job was kind of to oversee and direct, you know, the residents to build up the town. I think the spirit of the act is that it's an experiment which has to happen primarily led by the residents, and the government is kind of making sure that it's following certain norms, and there are lots of foreign nationals, so visas are involved, and so on and so forth. So externally, administratively, there are two very different setups. So Orville has an officer appointed by the government of India, and it has lots of internal decision-making groups, like the residents' assembly and the working committee and so on. I have to say that even as we are talking about all this, the last couple of years has seen a certain amount of churning in Orville, because many of these issues have come up in terms of what is the responsibility and role of the government, of the working groups. And there is a certain tension, which maybe you can, you know, explore when you are here and see for yourself. But so administratively, there are differences. The other major difference is that, as I mentioned, the life an organization of the ashram is already in place. We're not a community that is growing in terms of infrastructure, and maybe a building here or there, but not, there's no aggressive growth because we are already you know, the space is already created. Auroville really is being built up, you know, from the ground up. And it took so many years just to green the place. And now the city and the organization of the city. So there's a lot of physical work in Auroville. Town planning, architecture, landscaping, building of roads. It's just a huge amount of karma yoga, which is waiting to be done in Auroville. In that respect, in the ashram, everyone is working, but the pattern is already quite set. The other thing about Auroville is that I think it's a lot more open, and the mother herself was clear that anyone who is committed to the ideal of Auroville is welcome, regardless of whether they are necessarily seeing themselves as devotees of Sri Aurobindo or the mother or not. I think the stress is much more on the spiritual quest, the change of human nature, the transformation of consciousness. I mean, that's really the key thing. And I think that there can be people who have different methods or ways of arriving at that. Also, of course, Auroville it's a township as opposed to an ashram. So the scope of life is kind of broader. So you have families, you have many other needs that a town has, which of course in the case of the ashram is different. So those are some of the sort of principal differences, but I do believe that both answer to needs in the development of the yoga. Both communities offer a space where sadhana happens in a format which is unique to both. And different people are drawn to different communities. And what I really love is the fact that there is so much of exchange and you know, transitioning that can happen between the two. And I have really benefited and learned a lot from my contacts with Aurovillians. And I always love welcoming Aurovillians to the ashram. And I feel like we have so much to learn from each other. Mm-hmm.